It's better to make a mistake with the full force of your being than to carefully avoid mistakes with a trembling spirit. Responsibility means recognizing both pleasure and price, making a choice based on that recognition, and then living with that choice without concern. Sock, I still think smoking is disgusting. Haven't I got the message across to you yet, Junior? Smoking is not disgusting. The habit is. I may smoke one cigarette a day, then not smoke one for 6 months. I may enjoy one cigarette a day or one a week without any unmanageable urges to have another. And when I do smoke, I don't pretend that my lungs won't pay a price. I follow appropriate action afterward to help counterbalance the negative effects. I just never imagined a warrior would smoke. He blew smoke rings at my nose. I never said that a warrior behaved in a way that you considered perfect, nor do all warriors act exactly as I do. But we all follow the house rules, you see. So whether or not my behavior meets your new standards or not, it should be clear to you that I have mastered all compulsions, all behavior. I have no habits. My actions are conscious, intentional, and complete. Socrates put out his cigarette, smiling at me. You've become too stuffy with all your pride and superior discipline. It's time we did a little celebrating. Then Socrates pulled out a bottle of gin from his desk. I just sat in disbelief, shaking my head. He mixed me a drink with gin and soda pop. Soda pop, I asked. We only have fruit juice here, and don't call me Pop, he said, reminding me of the words he'd spoken to me so long ago. Now here he was, offering me a gin and ginger ale, drinking his straight. So, he said, drinking the gin quickly. Time to party. No holds barred. I like your enthusiasm, Sock, but I have a hard workout on Monday. Get your coat, Sonny, and follow me. I did. The only thing I remember clearly is that it was Saturday night in San Francisco. We started early and never stopped moving. The evening was a blur of lights, tinkling glasses, and laughter. I do remember Sunday morning. It was about 5 o'clock. My head was throbbing. We were walking down Mission, crossing 4th Street. I could barely see the street signs through the thick early morning fog that had rolled in. Suddenly, Sock stopped and stared into the fog. I stumbled into him, giggled, then woke up quickly. Something was wrong. A large, dark shape emerged from the mist. My half-forgotten dreams flashed into my mind, but vanished as I saw another shape, then a third. 3 men. 2 of them, tall, lean, tense, blocked our way. The third approached us and drew a stiletto from his worn leather jacket. I felt my pulse pounding through my temples. "Give me your money," he commanded. Not thinking clearly, I stepped toward him, reaching for my wallet, and stumbled forward. He was startled and rushed toward me, slashing with his knife. Socrates, moving faster than I'd ever seen before, caught the man's wrist, whirled around, and threw him into the street, just as another thug lunged for me. He never touched me. Socrates had kicked his legs out from under him with a lightning leg sweep. Before the third attacker could even move, Sock was upon him, taking him down with a wrist lock and a sweeping motion of his arm. One of the men started to get up when Socrates let out a powerful shout, and the man fell backward. But then the leader had picked himself out of the street, found his knife, and was limping furiously toward Socrates. Sock stood up, lifted the man he'd been sitting on, and threw him toward the knife man, yelling, "Catch!" They tumbled to the concrete. Then, in a wild rage, all three came screaming at us in a last, desperate assault. The next few minutes were blurred. I remember being pushed by Socrates and falling. Then it was quiet, except for a moan. Socrates stood still, then shook his arms loose and took a deep breath. He threw the knives into the sewer. Then he turned to me. "You okay?" "Except for my head." "You get hit?" "Only by alcohol. What happened?" He turned to the 3 men stretched out on the pavement, knelt and felt their pulses. Turning them over almost tenderly, he gave gentle prodding motions, checking them for injuries. Only then did I realize he was doing his best to heal them. "Call a police ambulance," he said, turning to me. I ran to a nearby phone booth and called. Then we left them and walked quickly to the bus station. I looked at Socrates. There were faint tears in his eyes, and for the first time since I'd known him, he looked pale and very tired. We spoke little on the bus ride home. That was fine with me. Talking hurt too much. When the bus stopped at University in Shattuck, Socrates got off and said, "You're invited to my office next Wednesday for a few drinks." Smiling at my pained expression, he continued, "Of herb tea." I got off the bus a block from home. My head was ready to explode. I felt like we'd lost the fight, and they were still beating on my head. I tried to keep my eyes closed as much as possible, walking the last block to the apartment house. "So this is what it feels like to be a vampire," I thought. "Sunlight can kill." Our celebration, steeped in an alcoholic haze, had taught me two things. First, I had needed to loosen up and let loose. Second, I was making a responsible choice. No more drinking. It wasn't worth the price. Besides, its pleasure was insignificant compared to what I was beginning to enjoy. Monday's gymnastics workout, the best in many months, made me even more determined that I would again become physically and spiritually whole. My leg was healing better than I'd had any right to expect. I had been taken under the wing of an extraordinary man. Walking home, I was so overwhelmed with gratitude that I knelt outside my apartment and touched the earth. Taking a handful of dirt in my hand, I gazed up through the emerald leaves shimmering in the breeze. For a few precious seconds, I seemed to slowly melt into the earth. Then, for the first time since I was a tiny child, I felt a life-giving presence without a name. Just then my analytical mind piped in, "Ah, so this is a spontaneous mystical experience," and the spell was broken. I returned to my earthly predicament. I was an ordinary man again, standing under an elm tree, holding dirt in his hand. I entered my apartment in a relaxed daze, read for a while, and fell asleep. Tuesday was a day of quiet, the quiet before the storm. Wednesday morning, I plunged into the mainstream of classes. My feelings of serenity, which I thought were permanent, soon gave way to subtle anxieties and old urges. After all my discipline training, I was profoundly disappointed. Then something new happened. I felt the awakening of a powerful intuitive wisdom that could be translated into words. Old urges will continue to arise, perhaps for years. Urges do not matter. Actions do. At first I thought my mind was playing tricks on me, but it wasn't a thought, it wasn't a voice. It was a feeling certainty. I felt like Socrates was inside me, a warrior within. This feeling was to remain with me. That evening I went to the station to tell Socrates about my mind's recent hyperactivity and about the feeling. I found him replacing a generator in a battered Mercury. He looked up, greeted me, and said casually, "Joseph died this morning." I fell back against the station wagon behind me, sick at the news of Joseph's death and Sock's apparent callousness. Finally, I was able to speak. "How did he die?" "Oh, very well, I imagine," Socrates smiled. "He had leukemia, you see. Joseph had been ill for a number of years. He hung in there for a long time. Fine warrior, that one." He spoke with affection, but almost casually, without a trace of sorrow. "Socrates, aren't you upset just a little?" He laid the wrench down. "There's no cause for unhappiness." "But Socrates, he's gone." Sock laughed softly. "Perhaps he's gone, perhaps not. Maybe he was never here." His laughter rang through the garage. "I want to understand you, but I can't. How can you be so casual about death? Will you feel the same way if I die?" "Of course," he laughed. "Dan, there are things you don't understand yet. For now, I can only say that death is a transformation. Perhaps a bit more radical than puberty," he smiled, "but nothing to be particularly upset about. It's one of the body's changes. When it happens, it happens. The warrior neither seeks death nor flees from it." His face grew more somber before he spoke again. "Death is not sad. The sad thing is that most people don't ever really live at all." Then his eyes filled with tears. We sat, two friends, in silence, before I walked home. I had just turned down a side street when the feeling came again. Tragedy is very different for the warrior and for the fool. Socrates hadn't been sad because he simply didn't consider Joseph's death a tragedy. I wasn't to realize why that was so until a long time later, deep within a mountain cave. Still, I couldn't shake the belief that I, and therefore Socrates, was supposed to be miserable when death struck. With that confusion ringing in my mind, I finally fell asleep. In the morning, I had my answer. Socrates had simply not met my expectations. I was filled with a new resolve. I had seen the futility of trying to live up to the conditioned expectation of others or of my own mind. I would, like the warrior, choose when, where, and how I would act. With that firm decision, I felt I had begun to understand the life of a warrior. That night, I walked into the station office and said to Socrates, "I'm ready. Nothing can stop me now." His fierce stare undid all my months of training. I quivered. He whispered, yet his voice seemed piercing, "Do not be so flippant. Perhaps you are ready, perhaps not. One thing is for certain. You don't have much time left. Each day that passes is one day closer to your death. We are not playing games here. Do you understand that?" I thought I heard the wind begin to howl outside. Without warning, I felt his warm fingers touch my temple. I was crouched in the brush. 10 feet away, facing my hiding place, was a swordsman over 7 feet tall. His massive, muscular body reeked of sulfur. His head, even his forehead, was covered by ugly, matted hair. His eyebrows were huge slashes on a hateful, twisted face. He stared malevolently at a young swordsman who faced him. 5 identical images of the giant materialized and encircled the young swordsman. All 6 of them laughed at once, a groaning, growling laugh deep in their bellies. I felt sick. The young warrior jerked his head right and left, swinging his sword frantically, whirling, dodging, and cutting through the air. He didn't have a chance. With a roar, all the images leaped toward him. Behind him, the giant's sword cut downward, hacking off his arm. He screamed in pain as the blood spurted and slashed blindly through the air in a last frenzied effort. The huge sword sliced again, and the young swordsman's head fell from his shoulders and rolled to the earth, a shocked expression on his face. "Ah!" I groaned involuntarily, nausea washing over me. The stink of sulfur overwhelmed me. A painful grip on my arm tore me from the bushes and flung me to the ground. When I opened my eyes, the dead eyes of the young swordsman's severed head, inches away from my face, silently warned me of my own impending doom. Then I heard the guttural voice of the giant. "Say farewell to life, young fool," the magician growled. His taunt enraged me, and I dove for the young warrior's sword and rolled to my feet, facing him. "I've been called a fool by far better than you, you slobbering eunuch." With a scream, I attacked, swinging my sword. The force of his parry knocked me off my feet. Suddenly there were 6 of him. I tried to keep my eye on the original as I leaped to my feet, but was no longer sure. They began to chant deep in their bellies. It became a low-pitched, horrible death rattle as they crept slowly toward me. Then the feeling came to me, and I knew what I had to do. "The giant represents the source of all your woes. He is your mind. He is the demon you must cut through. Don't be deluded like the fallen warrior. Keep your focus." Absurdly, my mind commented, "One hell of a time for a lesson." Then I was back to my immediate predicament, feeling an icy calm. I lay down on my back and closed my eyes as if surrendering to my fate, the sword in my hands, its blade across my chest and cheek. The illusions could fool my eyes, but not my ears. Only the real swordsman would make a sound as he walked. I heard him behind me. He had only 2 choices, to walk away or to kill. He chose to kill. I listened intently. Just as I sensed his sword about to cut downward, I drove my blade upward with all my might and felt it pierce, tearing upward through cloth, flesh, and muscle. A terrible scream, and I heard the thud of his body. Face down, impaled on my sword, was the demon. "You almost didn't come back that time," said Socrates. I ran to the bathroom, where I was immediately thoroughly sick. When I came out, he had made some chamomile tea with licorice, for the nerves and the stomach. I started to tell Socrates about the journey when he interrupted me. "I was hiding in the bush behind you, watching the whole thing. I nearly sneezed once, sure glad I didn't. I certainly wasn't anxious to tangle with that character. For a moment I thought I was going to have to, but you handled yourself pretty well, Dan." Why, thanks, Sock, I beamed. On the other hand, you seem to have missed the point that nearly cost you your life. Now it was my turn to interrupt. The main point I was concerned with was the end of that giant's blade, I joked, and I didn't miss the point. Is that so? Sock, I've been battling illusions my whole life, preoccupied with every petty personal problem. I've dedicated my life to self-improvement without grasping the one problem that sent me seeking in the first place. While trying to make everything in the world work out for me, I always succumb to my own mind, always preoccupied with me, me, me. The giant is my only real problem in life. It's my mind. And Socrates, I said with growing excitement, just realizing what I'd done, I cut through it. There was no doubt about that, he said. Sock, what would have happened if the giant had won? What then? Don't talk of such things, he said darkly. I want to know. Would I have really died? Very likely, he said. At the very least, you would have gone mad. Just then, the tea kettle began to shriek. Chapter 5. The Mountain Path. Socrates poured steaming hot tea into our twin mugs and spoke the first encouraging words I'd heard in many months. You're ready to progress further toward the one goal. What's that? When you discover that, you'll already be there. In the meantime, your training can now move to a different arena. A change, a sign of progress. I was getting excited. Finally, we're going to get moving again, I thought. Socrates, I asked, what different arena are you referring to? For one thing, I'm no longer going to be an answer machine. You're going to have to find the answers from within. And you begin now. Go out back, behind the station, behind the trash bin. There, in the very corner of the lot, against the wall, you'll find a large, flat stone. Sit on that stone until you have something of value to tell me. I paused. That's all? That's it. Sit and open your mind to your own inner wisdom. I went outside, found the rock, and sat in the darkness. First, random thoughts drifted through my mind. Then I thought of all the important concepts I'd learned in my years at school. An hour went by, then two, then three. The sun would rise in another few hours, and I was getting cold. I began to slow my breathing and to vividly imagine my belly as warm. Before long, I felt comfortable again. Dawn came. The only thing that I could think of to tell him was a realization I'd had during a psychology lecture. I got up on stiff, sore legs and hobbled into the office. Socrates, looking relaxed and comfortable at his desk, said, "Ah, so soon? Well, what is it?" I was almost embarrassed to say it, but hoped he'd be satisfied. "Okay, Sock. Beneath all our apparent differences, we all share the same human needs and fears. We're all on the same path together, guiding one another. And that understanding can give us compassion." "Not bad," he said. "Back to the rock." "But it's going to be dawn. You're leaving." "That's no problem," he grinned. "I'm sure you'll have thought of something by tonight." "Tonight? He pointed to the door. Sitting on the rock, my whole body aching, I thought back to my childhood. I considered my past, searching for insights. I tried to compress all that had transpired in the months with Socrates into a witty aphorism. I thought of the classes I was missing and the gymnastics workouts I'd have to miss, and the excuse I'd give the coach. Maybe I'd tell him I had been sitting on a rock in a gas station. That would be a crazy enough story to make him laugh. The sun crept with agonizing slowness across the sky. I sat hungry, irritated, then depressed as darkness fell. I had nothing for Socrates. Then, about the time he was due in, it came to me. He wanted something deep, something more cosmic. I concentrated with renewed effort. I saw him walk into the office, waving to me. I redoubled my efforts. Then, about midnight, I had it. I couldn't even walk, so I stretched for a few minutes before shuffling into the office. I've seen beneath people's social masks to their common fears and troubled minds, and that has made me cynical, because I haven't yet been able to get beyond all that to see the light within them. I figured that was a revelation of major proportions. "Excellent," Sock announced. Just as I started to sigh, he added, "But not quite what I had in mind. Can you bring me something more moving?" I roared with anger at no one in particular and stomped out to my philosopher's stone. Something more moving, he had said. Was that a hint? I naturally thought back to my recent workouts in the gymnastics room. My teammates now clucked about me like mother hens. Recently I was doing giant swings around the high bar, missing a pirouette change, and had to jump off from the top of the bar. I knew I was going to land on my feet pretty hard, but before I even hit the ground, Sid and Herb caught me in midair and set me down gently. "Be careful, Dan," Sid scolded. "You want to snap your leg before it heals?" None of that seemed very relevant to my present situation, but I let my awareness relax, hoping that maybe the feeling would advise me. Nothing. I was getting so stiff and sore I couldn't concentrate anymore. I didn't think it would be cheating to stand on the rock and practice a few flowing movements of Tai Chi, the Chinese form of slow-motion exercise that Sok had shown me. As I bent my knees and gracefully rocked back and forth, my hips turning and arms floating in the air, I let my breath control the shifting of my weight. My mind emptied, then filled with the scene. A few days before, I had jogged slowly and carefully to Provo Square in the middle of Berkeley, across from City Hall and directly adjacent to Berkeley High School. To help relax, I began swaying back and forth in the movements of Tai Chi. I concentrated on softness and balance, feeling like seaweed floating in the ocean. A few boys and girls from the high school stopped and watched me, but I paid them no attention, letting my concentration flow with the movements. When I finished and walked over to put my sweatpants back on over my running shorts, my ordinary awareness reasserted itself. "I wonder if I looked good," I thought. My attention was then captured by two pretty teenagers who were watching me and giggling. "I guess those girls are impressed," I thought as I put both legs into one pant leg, lost my balance, and fell on my ass. A few other students joined the girls in their laughter. I felt embarrassed for a moment, but then lay back and laughed with them. I wondered, still standing on the rock, why that incident could be important. Then it hit me. I knew I had something of value to tell Socrates. I walked into the office, stood before Sok's desk, and said, "There are no ordinary moments." Sok smiled. "Welcome back." I collapsed on the couch, and he made tea. After that, I treated every moment in the gym, on the ground as well as in the air, as special, worthy of my full attention. Further lessons would be necessary, though, for as Socrates had explained to me more than once, the ability to extend razor-sharp attention to every moment in my daily life would require more practice. The next day in the early afternoon before workout, I took advantage of the blue sky and warm sunshine to sit shirtless in the redwood grove and meditate. I hadn't been sitting for more than 10 minutes when someone grabbed me and started shaking me back and forth. I rolled away panting and stood in a crouch. Then I saw who it was. "Socrates, you have absolutely no manners sometimes." "Wake up," he said. "No more sleeping on the job. There's work to be done." "I'm off duty now," I teased. "Lunch hour. See the next clerk." "It's time to get moving, Chief Sitting Bull. Go get your running shoes and meet me back here in 10 minutes. I went home and put on my old Nike shoes and hurried back to the redwood grove. Socrates was nowhere in sight. Then I saw her. Joy! She was wearing little blue satin running shorts, yellow tiger shoes, and a t-shirt tied at the waist. I ran up to her and hugged her. I wanted to talk, to tell her my feelings, my plans, but she held her fingers to my lips and said, "Time to talk later, Danny. Now, just follow me." She demonstrated a tricky warm-up, a combination of Tai Chi movements, visualizations, calisthenics, and coordination exercises to warm up the mind as well as the body. In a few minutes, I felt light, loose, and full of energy. Without warning, I heard Joy say, "On your mark, get set, go." She took off, running upwards through campus toward the hills of Strawberry Canyon. I followed, huffing and puffing. Not yet in running shape, I began to trail far behind. Angrily, I pushed harder, my lungs burning. Up ahead, Joy had stopped at the top of the rise overlooking the football stadium. I could hardly breathe by the time I reached her. "What took you so long, sweetheart?" she said, hands on her hips. Then she bounced off again, up the canyon, heading for the base of the fire trails, narrow dirt roads that wound up through the hills. Doggedly, I pursued her, hurting as I hadn't hurt in a long time, but determined to run her down. As we neared the trails, she slowed down and began running at a humane pace. Then, to my dismay, She reached the base of the lower trails, and instead of turning around, led me up another grade, far into the hills. I offered up a silent prayer of thanks as she turned around at the end of the lower trails, instead of heading up the agonizingly steep quarter-mile connector that joined the lower and upper trails. As we ran more easily back down a long grade, Joy began to talk. "Danny, Socrates asked me to introduce you to your new phase of training. Meditation is a valuable exercise, but eventually you have to open your eyes and look around. This is a way of action, and action is what you'll get." I, meanwhile, had been listening thoughtfully, staring at the ground. I answered, "Yes, I understand that, Joy. That's why I train in gymnast." I looked up just in time to see her lovely figure disappear in the distance. I was completely drained when, later that afternoon, I walked into the gym. I lay on the mat and stretched and stretched and stretched until the coach came over and asked, "Are you going to stretch all day, Danny, or would you like to try one of our other nice activities we have? We call them gymnastics events." "Okay, Hal," I smiled. I tried some very simple tumbling moves, for the first time testing my leg. Running was one thing, tumbling was another. Advanced tumbling moves could exert as much as 1,600 pounds of force as the legs drove into the ground, thrusting the body skyward. I also began to test my trampoline legs for the first time in a year. Bouncing rhythmically into the air, I somersaulted again and again. Pat and Dennis, my two trampoline mates, yelled, "Milman, will you take it easy? You know your leg isn't healed yet." I wondered what they'd say if they knew I had just run for miles in the hills. Walking to the station that night, I was so tired I could hardly keep my eyes open. I stepped out of the cool October air and into the office, ready for some soothing tea and relaxing talk. I should have known better. "Come over here and face me. Stand like this," Socrates demonstrated, his knees half bent, his hips forward, and his shoulders back. He put his hands out in front of him as if holding an invisible beach ball. "Hold that position without moving and breathe slowly while I tell you a few things you need to know about proper training." He sat down behind his desk and watched me. Right away my legs started to ache and tremble. "How long do I have to stay this way?" I groaned. Ignoring my question, he said, "You move well, Dan, compared to the average man, but your body is nevertheless full of knots. Your muscles hold too much tension, and tense muscles require more energy to move. So first of all, you have to learn how to release stored tensions." My legs were starting to shake with pain and fatigue. "This hurts." "It only hurts because your muscles are like rocks." "All right, you've made your point." Socrates only smiled and left the office abruptly, leaving me standing bent-legged, sweating and shaking. He came back with a wiry gray tomcat who had obviously seen some action on the front lines. "You need to develop muscles like this cat so that you can move like us," he said, scratching the purring feline behind the ears. My forehead was beaded with perspiration. The pain in my shoulders and legs was intense. Finally, Socrates said, "At ease." I stood up immediately, wiping my forehead and shaking loose. "Come over here and introduce yourself to this cat." It purred with delight as Sock scratched it behind the ears. "We're both going to serve as your coaches, aren't we, Puss?" The cat meowed loudly, and I patted it. "Now, squeeze its leg muscles slowly, to the bone." "I might hurt it, Sock." "Squeeze." I pressed deeper and deeper into the cat's muscles until I felt the bone. The cat watched me with curiosity and kept purring. "Now squeeze my calf muscle," Sock said. "Oh, I couldn't, Sock. We don't know each other well enough." "Do it." I squeezed and was surprised to feel that his muscles felt just like the cat's, yielding like firm jelly. "Your turn," he said, reaching down and squeezing my calf muscle. "Ow!" I yelped. "I'd always thought hard muscles were normal," I said, rubbing my calves. "They are normal, Dan, but you must go far beyond normal, beyond usual, beyond common and reasonable, into the realm of the warrior. You've always tried to become superior in an ordinary realm. Now you're going to learn to become ordinary in a superior realm." Socrates petted the cat once more and let it out the door. It hung around for a moment, then wandered off. He then began my introduction to the subtle elements of physical training. By now you can appreciate how the mind imposes tension on the body. You've accumulated worries and concerns and other mental debris for years. Now it's time for you to release old tensions that have become locked into the muscles. Socrates handed me a pair of running shorts and told me to change into them. When I returned, he was in trunks too, and had spread a white sheet on the carpet. What are you going to do if a customer comes? He pointed to his overalls hanging by the door. Now, he said, do exactly as I do. He began by rubbing a sweet-scented oil over his left foot. I copied every step as he squeezed, pressed, and dug very deeply into the bottom, top, sides, and between the toes, stretching, pressing, and pulling. Massage the bones, not just the flesh and muscle. Deeper, he said. Half an hour later, we were through with a left foot. We repeated the same process with a right foot. This process went on for hours, covering every part of the body. I learned things about my muscles and my bones I'd never known before. I could feel where they were attached. I could feel the shape of the bones. It was amazing that I, an athlete, was so unfamiliar with my body. Socrates had quickly slipped into overalls a few times when the bell clanged, but otherwise we were undisturbed. When I donned my clothes 5 hours later, it felt as if I had also donned a new body. Returning from a customer, Soc said, "You've cleaned many old fears from your body. Take the time to repeat this process at least once a week for the next 6 months. Pay attention to your legs. Work on the site of your injury every day for 2 weeks." More homework, I thought. The sky began to grow light. I yawned. Time to go home. As I was walking out the door, Socrates told me to be at the base of the fire trails at 1 p.m. sharp that afternoon. I arrived early at the trails. I stretched and warmed up lazily. My body felt very loose and light after the bone massage, but with only a few hours' sleep, I was still tired. A light drizzle had begun. All in all, I didn't feel like running anywhere, with anyone. Then I heard a rustling in the bushes nearby. I stood quietly and watched, expecting to see a deer emerge from the thicket. Out of the foliage stepped Joy, looking like an elf princess, wearing dark green shorts and a lime T-shirt emblazoned with the words, "Happiness is a full tank." A gift from Socrates, no doubt. "Joy, before we run, let's sit down and talk." She smiled and sped away. As I pursued her up around the first curve, almost slipping on the wet clay earth, I felt the weakness in my legs after yesterday's exercise. I was soon winded, and my right leg throbbed, but I didn't complain. I was thankful that she kept her pace slower than yesterday's. We approached the end of the lower trail without talking. My breathing was labored, and I had no energy left. I started to turn around when she said, "Upsy-daisy," and started up the steep connector. "No," my mind screamed. "Definitely not," said my weary muscles. Then I looked at Joy bounding lightly up the hill as if it were level. With a rebel yell, I took the hill. I looked like a drunken gorilla, hunched over, grunting, panting, blindly clambering up, 2 steps forward, sliding 1 step back. At the top, it leveled off. Joy was already standing there, smelling the wet pine needles, looking as peaceful and content as Bambi. My lungs were begging for more air. "I have an idea," I panted. "Let's walk the rest of the way. No, let's crawl. It gives us more time to talk. How does that sound? Pretty good?" "Let's go," she said merrily. I struggled over a small hill that seemed like the Colorado Rockies and saw Joy squatting, playing with some wild rabbits as they hopped across the trail. When I stumbled up to her, the rabbits leaped into the bushes. Joy looked up at me, smiling, and said, "Oh, there you are." By some heroic effort, I leaned forward and managed to accelerate past her, but she just shot ahead and disappeared again. We had climbed 1,100 feet. I was now high above the bay and could see the university below me. I was, however, in no condition or state of mind to appreciate the view. I felt very close to passing out. I had a vision of me buried on the hill, under the wet earth, with a marker. "Here lies Dan. Nice guy, good try." The rain had increased, but I ran as if in a trance, leaning forward, stumbling, pulling one leg forward after the other. My shoes felt like iron boots. Then I rounded a corner and saw a final hill that looked nearly vertical. Again, my mind refused, my body stopped, but up there at the top of the hill stood Joy, with her hands on her hips as if challenging me. Somehow I managed to tip forward and start my legs moving again. I plodded, I pushed, I strained and groaned up the last endless steps until I ran right into her. "Whoa, boy, whoa," she laughed. "You're finished. All done." We walked back down the hill, giving me welcome time to recover and talk. "Joy, it seems like pushing this hard, this fast, isn't natural. I wasn't prepared to run this far. I don't think it's very good for the body." "You're right," she said. "This wasn't a test of your body, but of your spirit. A test to see if you would go on, not just with the hill, but with your training. If you had stopped, it would have been the end. But you passed, Danny. You passed with flying colors." The wind began to blow, and the rain poured, drenching us. Then Joy stopped and took my head in her hands. Water dripped from our sopping hair and ran down our cheeks. I reached around her waist and was drawn into her shining eyes, and we kissed. I laughed at the way we both looked, like sponges that needed to be wrung out, and said, "I'll race you to the bottom." I took off and got a good head start. What the hell, I figured, I can roll down these damn trails. She won, of course. Later that afternoon, dry and warm, I stretched lazily in the gym with Sid, Gary, Scott, and Herb. The warmth of the gym was a pleasurable shelter from the pounding rain outside. In spite of my grueling run, I still had a reserve of energy. By the time I stepped into the office that evening and took off my shoes, the reservoir had evaporated. I wanted to flop my aching body down on the couch and take a nap for 10 or 12 hours. Resisting the urge, I settled as gracefully as I could manage and faced Socrates. I was amused to see that he'd rearranged the decor. Pictures of golfers, skiers, tennis players, and gymnasts were up on the wall. On his desk sat a baseball mitt and a football. Socrates even wore a sweatshirt that said, "Ohio State Coaching Staff." It seemed that we'd entered the sports phase of my training. While Socrates made us some of his special wake-up tea he called Thundering Tarnation, I told him about my gymnastics progress. He listened, nodding with approval, and then said words that intrigued me. "Gymnastics can be even more than you've yet comprehended. To help you understand this, you need to see precisely why you enjoy your acrobatic art." "Can you explain that, Soc?" He then reached into his desk and took out 3 lethal-looking daggers. "Never mind, Soc," I said. "I don't really need an explanation." "Stand up," he ordered. When I did, he casually threw a knife, underhand, straight toward my chest. I leaped aside, falling under the couch as the knife dropped soundlessly to the carpet. I lay there shocked, my heart beating overtime. "Good," he said. "You overreacted a bit, but good. Now stand up and catch the next one." Just then the kettle started whistling, a reprieve. "Well," I said, rubbing my sweaty palms together, "tea time." "It will keep," he said. "Watch me closely." Sock tossed a glittering blade straight into the air. I watched it spin and drop. As it fell, he matched the speed of the blade with the downward motion of his hand and grasped the handle between his thumb and fingers, like a pincer, gripping firmly. "Now you try. Notice how I caught it so that even if I happened to grab the blade, it wouldn't slice me." He tossed another knife toward me. More relaxed, I stepped out of the way and made only a feeble attempt at catching it. "If you drop the next one, I'm going to start throwing overhand," he promised. This time my eyes were glued to the handle as it came near. I reached out. "Hey, I did it!" "Aren't sports wonderful?" he said. For a while we became totally immersed in throwing and catching. Then he paused. "Now let me tell you about Satori, a Zen concept. Satori is the warrior state of being. It occurs at the moment when the mind is free of thought, pure awareness. The body is active, sensitive, relaxed, and the emotions are open and free. Satori is what you experienced when the knife was flying toward you." "You know, Sok, I've had that feeling many times, especially during competitions. Often I'm concentrating so hard I can't even hear the applause." "Yes, that is the experience of Satori. And now, if you grasp what I say next, you'll understand the right use of sports, or painting, or music, or any other active or creative gateway to Satori. You imagine that you love gymnastics, but it's merely the wrapping for a gift within, Satori. The right use of gymnastics is to focus your full attention and feeling on your actions. Gymnastics draws you into the moment of truth, when your life is on the line, like a dueling samurai. It demands your full attention." "Like in the middle of a double somersault," I said. Yes, he answered. That's why gymnastics is a warrior's art, a way to train mind and emotions as well as the body, a doorway to Satori. Your final step is to expand this clarity into daily life. Then Satori will become your reality, your key to the gate. I sighed. It seems like such a distant possibility, Socrates. When you ran up the hill after joy, he grinned, you didn't look wistfully at the top of the mountain. You looked directly in front of you and took one step at a time. That's how it works. The house rules, right? He smiled in answer. As I yawned and stretched, Socrates advised, you'd better get some sleep. You're beginning special training tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. at the Berkeley High School track. When my alarm rang at 6:15, I had to drag myself out of bed, submerge my head in cold water, do some deep breathing by the open window, then scream into my pillow to wake up. I was alert by the time I hit the streets. I jogged slowly, crossing Shattuck, and cut down Alston Way past the Berkeley YMCA, the post office, then across Milvia, into the high school grounds where Soc was awaiting me. I soon discovered that he had a regular program planned for me. Using the principles of Aikido, a flowing martial art, Socrates was able to throw me without any apparent effort, no matter how I tried to push him, grab him, punch him, or even tackle him. Never struggle with anyone or anything, he said. When you're pushed, then pull. And when you're pulled, push. Find the natural course and bend with it. Then you join with nature's power. His actions were the proof of his words. Soon it was time to go. See you tomorrow, he said. Same time, same place. Stay home tonight and practice your exercises, Dan. Remember, make your breathing so slow that it wouldn't disturb a feather in front of your nose. He moved off as if on roller skates, and I ran toward my apartment, so relaxed that I felt like the wind was blowing me home. In the gym that day, I did my best to apply what I'd learned, letting movements happen instead of trying to do them. My giant swings on the high bar seemed to go around by themselves. I swung, hopped, and somersaulted to handstand after handstand on the parallel bars. My circles, scissors, and pommel work on the horse felt as if I were supported by strings from the ceiling, weightless. And finally, my tumbling legs were returning. Sock and I met just after sunrise every morning. I would stride along, and Sock would run leaping like a gazelle. Each day I grew more relaxed, and my reflexes became lightning quick. One day, however, when we were in the middle of our warm-up run, he suddenly stopped, looking paler than I'd ever seen him before. I'd better sit down, he said. Socrates, can I do anything? Yep. It seemed difficult for him to talk. Just keep running, Dan. I'll just sit quietly. I did as he asked, but kept my eyes on his still figure, sitting with eyes closed, looking proud and straight, but somehow older. As we'd agreed weeks before, I didn't come to see him in the evening at the station, but I called to see how he was. I was relieved when Socrates answered. "How's it going, coach?" I asked. "In the pink," he said, "but I've hired an assistant to take over for a few weeks." "Okay, Soc, take care of yourself." The next day I saw my assistant coach run onto the track, and literally I jumped for joy. I held her gently, hugging her and whispering in her ear. She threw me just as gently, head over heels, onto the lawn. If that wasn't mortifying enough, she beat me kicking field goals, making me, a world champion, blush with shame. I doubled the number of exercises Sock had given me. I trained with a greater concentration than ever before. I awoke at 4 a.m., practiced Tai Chi till dawn, and ran into the hills before meeting Joy each day. I said nothing to anyone about my extra training. I carried her image with me into my classes and into the gym. I wanted to see her, to hold her, but first I had to catch her. For the present, the most I could hope for was to beat her at her own games. A few weeks later, I was back running, skipping, and leaping across the track with Socrates, who was back in action. My legs felt filled with power and spring. "Socrates," I said, sprinting ahead and falling behind, playing tag with him, "you've been pretty closed-mouthed about your daily habits. I've no idea what you're like when we're not together." "Well?" Grinning at me, he leaped forward about 10 feet, then sprinted off around the track. I took off after him until I was within talking range. "Are you going to answer me?" "Nope," he said. the subject was closed. When we finally finished our stretching and meditation exercises for the morning, Socrates came up to me, put his arm around my shoulders, and said, "Dan, you've been a willing and apt pupil. From now on, you're to arrange your own schedule. Do the exercises as you feel they're needed. I'm going to give you something extra because you've earned it. I'm going to coach you in gymnastics." I had to laugh. I couldn't help it. "You're going to coach me in gymnastics? I think you're overreaching yourself this time, Sock." I ran quickly down the turf and snapped into a round-off backhand spring and a high layout somersault with a double twist. Socrates walked over to me and said, "You know, I can't do that." "Hot dog," I yelled, "I finally found something I can do that you can't." "I did notice," he added, "that your arms need to stretch more when you set for the twist. Oh, and your head is too far back on takeoff." "Sock, you old bluffer, you're right," I said, realizing that I had set my head back too far, and my arms did need to stretch more. "Once we straighten out your technique a bit, we can work on your attitude," he added, with a final twist of his own. "I'll be seeing you in the gym." "But Socrates, I already have a coach, and don't know if Hal or the other gymnasts will take to your wandering around the gymnastics room." "Oh, I'm sure you'll think of something to tell them," he said. I certainly would. That afternoon, during the team meeting, prior to workout, I told the coach and team that my eccentric grandfather from Chicago, who used to be a member of the Turner's Gymnastics Club, was visiting for a couple of weeks and wanted to come watch me. "He's a nice old guy, really spry. He fancies himself quite a coach. If you all wouldn't mind and would be willing to humor him a little, he's not quite playing with a full deck, if you know what I mean. I'm sure he won't disrupt workout too much." The consensus was favorable. "Oh, by the way," I added, "he likes to be called Marilyn." I could hardly keep a straight face. "Marilyn?" everyone echoed. "Yeah, I know it's kind of bizarre, but you'll understand when you meet him." Rick said, "Maybe seeing Marilyn in action will help us understand you a little better, Milman. They say it's hereditary." They laughed and started warming up. Socrates was entering my domain this time, and I'd show him. I wondered if he'd like his new nickname. Today, I had a little surprise planned for the whole team. I'd been holding back in the gym, and they had no idea that I'd recovered so fully. I arrived at the gym early and walked into the coach's office. He was shuffling through papers scattered on the desk when I spoke. "Hal," I said, "I want to be in the inter-squad competition." Peering above his glasses, he said sympathetically, "You know you're not fully healed yet. I've talked to the team doctor, Dan, and he said your leg will need at least 3 more months. "Hal," I pulled him aside and whispered, "I can do it today, now. I've been doing some extra work outside the gym. Give me a chance." He hesitated. "Well, okay, one event at a time, and we'll see how it goes." We all warmed up together from event to event around the small gymnastics room, swinging, tumbling, vaulting, pressing to handstands. I started out performing moves I hadn't done in over a year. I was saving the real surprises for later. Then the first event came, floor exercise. Everyone waited, staring at me as I stood ready to begin my routine, as if wondering whether my leg would stand the strain. Everything clicked, the double back, a smooth press to handstand, keeping a light rhythm going on the dance elements that I'd created. Another sky-high tumbling pass, then a final aerial sequence. I became aware of the whistling and applauding. Sid and Josh looked at one another in amazement. Next event, Josh went first on rings, then Sid, Chuck, and Gary. Finally, it was my turn. I adjusted my handguards, made sure the tape on my wrists was secure, and jumped up on the rings. Josh stilled my swing, then stepped back. My muscles twitched with anticipation. Inhaling, I pulled up to an inverted hang, then slowly pulled and pressed my body up to an iron cross. I heard muffled tones of excitement as I swung smoothly down, then up again to a front uprise. I pressed slowly to a handstand with straight arms and straight body. "Well, I'll be damned," Hal said, using the strongest language I'd ever heard him use. Bailing out of the handstand, I did a fast, light giant swing and locked it without a tremor. After a high double somersault dismount, I landed with only a small step. And so it went. After completing my final routine, again greeted by hoots and shouts of surprise, I noticed Socrates sitting quietly in the corner, smiling. He must have seen it all. I waved to him to come on over. "Guys, I'd like to introduce my grandfather," I said. "This is Sid, Tom, Herb, Gary, Joel, Josh. Guys, this is..." "We're pleased to meet you, Marilyn," they said in a chorus. Socrates looked puzzled for the merest moment, then said, "Hello, I'm glad to meet you, too. I wanted to see what kind of crowd Dan runs around with." They grinned, probably deciding they liked him. "I hope you don't think it's too strange my being called Marilyn," he said casually. "My real name is Merrill, but I got stuck with a nickname." "Did Dan ever tell you what he was called at home?" he chuckled. "No," they said eagerly. "What?" "Well, I'd better not say. I don't want to embarrass him. He can always tell you if he wants to." Socrates, the fox, looked at me and solemnly said, "You don't have to be ashamed of it, Dan." As they walked off, they said to me, "Bye, Suzette. Bye, Josephine. See you later, Geraldine." "Oh, hell, look what you've started, Marilyn." I stomped down to the showers. For the rest of the week, Socrates never took his eyes off me. Occasionally, he'd turn to another gymnast and offer some superb advice, which always seemed to work. I was astonished at his knowledge. After high bar, he said, "Dan, you still need to learn to meditate your actions." "What do you mean, meditate in action, Soc?" "Meditating in action is different from doing it. To do, there must be a doer, a self-conscious someone performing. But when you meditate in action, you've already released all thoughts, even the thought of I. There is no you left to do it. In forgetting yourself, you become what you do. So your action is free, spontaneous." On and on it went. He watched every expression on my face, listened to every comment I made. He told me to constantly pay more attention to my mental and emotional form. Some people heard